Hey, everybody. I'm Lisa Burwell, your host of V-Speaks, Conversations with Heart and Soul. We are in season three, day five, Friday. Happy Friday, everybody. It's been a big, long week, and we are rounding it down, and we have somebody that is just fascinating, that is going to be able to educate, inspire, and help us all be better humans by talking about the Black Bear Project that Eric Salas, owner of AZA Productions, founded. Eric, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Very welcome. So you and I go back about 30 years, that can even be how does this happen? How does 30 years come and go so seemingly so fast? And we were in different places in our life. Obviously, life takes many journeys, but the irony of having this podcast here is that I first met you when you were in this office right next to me right now where Route 30A is. And that's where we met.
That's
and you were an artist at the time, and you were also running the whole distribution and production for the art gallery,
Quincy's Toys and Games,
which was a big successful endeavor.
Yeah, it was. You know, Quincy started right at the beginning of the e-commerce, and the owners were out of New York, and they really figured out how to really target that market. So if you did a Google search for toys, Quincy came up first back in the day.
Wow. What do they do now? Do you ever keep in touch with them?
I talked to them probably, I feel like a decade ago. And then since then, you know how life is. It's like everybody goes in different directions.
Yeah, I know. It's so crazy.
Last I heard, 9/11 was such a traumatic experience for them. I believe Dorothy went into natural health type things and start teaching meditation, yoga. Yeah. I'm not really sure, to be honest.
Okay, well, you could see how that would happen.
Right.
So I heard a speech recently that you gave at the Seaside Institute a couple months ago where your fine photography is hanging on the wall still right now and was that night. For one, to set it all up, this is a somewhat a lifelong mission, which Eric's, you know, you'll talk about how you have, since you're a kid or teenager, been interested in this, but the photography is amazing.
Thank you.
And I know you're a filmmaker, and you have been a filmmaker for a long time. We'll talk about some of the really interesting things that you got to do, especially what I always like hearing is the Prudence Junction that you had. Okay, we'll talk about that a little bit. and how you got to where you are right now. But, like, all the things that you journeyed on along your path seem to be like just like step by step by step to lead you to where you are today with your passion.
Absolutely.
So, I don't know, where do we begin on this one? Why don't we jump into when did you start Paper Bear Found, the project?
So the actual official start of Paper Bear, I would say, was the very end of 2019 is when Sean Couch and I first met.
Okay.
And I mean, I'd been thinking about it for close to a decade before then. And then Sean and I bumped into each other and I kind of mentioned the idea to him, and him and his family had just moved into the area. I think it was 2 years prior to that. And, but it didn't really kick off until beginning of 2020, right when COVID hit.
So it's really new.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, COVID was sort of like a suspended period of time in the universe, but you were still like making something happen.
Yeah.
So I remember now, this is about 3 years ago, maybe 2.5 years ago, I bumped into you in the parking lot out here when you were pulling in and you started telling me about what you were doing. And the quick snapshot of that, because it's fascinating and listeners are going to love it, is that you were telling me about this project and you were so inspired and jazzed by it. And you dress in a ghillie suit, and I didn't know what a ghillie suit was at the time until you educate me on that, and that is basically camouflage gear where you're embedded with the bears and all that goes along with that, that I'll let you tell that story. And you have basically lived with bears collectively. I mean, what is the amount of time? I mean, I know you've been out there 2 weeks at a time. And
So over two and a half years, I have over 8,000 hours with them, with the project. And so, you know, the question I get most often is you lived with the bears, so you slept in their den with them. And no, I mean, there's definitely times where I was out there and we were all sleeping. So I can say, yes, I slept with them, but they're very food driven in that. So their movements change throughout the year. So as you get more into summer and all the berries and nuts and stuff are coming into season, their activity is a lot higher. And so a lot of people think they sleep all night. It's all over the place. They'll eat for a couple hours, take a nap, start walking and moving. So, you know, many days I'd go out there and get out there at, you know, 2-3 in the morning maybe, and then be with them until 5 or 6 after night. And then next day I might only be out there with them for 8 hours. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of it was just getting the footage I needed. And so much of it was not only getting the footage, but understanding and learning them and their behavior, so I knew how to get the footage, but also learning how to live and interact with black bears. Because the biggest thing for us was not doing anything that would harm them in the mm-hmm. in the long run. So when I decided to do this part of the project, I put a set of rules on myself. So I'd never stand in front of them. I would never dress as a human. So I always wore the ghillie suit. Mm-hmm. For anybody that doesn't know what a ghillie suit is, you just think of those military movies and the guy, you don't see him, and then all of a sudden this grass bush stands up. That's a ghillie suit. And then I would never speak a human language in front of them. So if I needed to communicate, I had to learn their communication style and, mm-hmm. and their language. Mm-hmm. And then I would never do anything to alter their behavior. And that was a big one, because if there was a specific shot that I needed, and I think this was part of the artist in me, because it was such a process, in that if I needed a specific shot, let's say I knew at exactly 8 a.m. in the morning at this week, the sun was going to come through the trees and it was going to hit this branch at this angle. So I knew if the bear came up the tree and was on that branch at that time for 30 minutes, I could get an amazing shot. So I would watch the bears. And when they hit a point where, okay, the bear's climbing this tree to get these acorns, then I would get out there before sunrise. I would climb 40 feet in the trees. I would mount cameras. I would set up a whole control center with remotes, and I would sit and wait. And that might take a month to get that 30-second shot. But when you got it, it's like, you know, it's
and
gold.
How far away are you from them physically when you just recounted that story?
It just depends. You know, in terms of how close did I get, like you saw the footage in the presentation with the cub, it practically was trying to climb in my lap and on my back. The mother, Tala, she and I, if this was her nose, we got about that close. But I always tried to keep, so I was always communicating to them, stay back. She got way more comfortable, and so did the cub. But the males, we were more like, we're both just kind of keeping our distance. And,
right.
A lot of communication. They're constantly communicating, and that's one of the things with human interactions is we just, people don't understand their communication, and so they misinterpret it 99% of the time. And what's amazing is that bear is talking to you almost nonstop once you get in contact or within proximity of it. It's communicating with you.
And how is that?
So usually what it's telling you is, I'm uncomfortable. Uh-huh. So it'll come in, and a lot of people say the bear hissed at me, and it's not hissing. It does a very deep, strong exhale of air, and that's its way of saying, I'm really uncomfortable with the situation. Mm-hmm. Then they'll start doing what's called jaw popping. They start clapping their jaws together. And so a lot of people are like, you know, it was trying to bite, or it's like, no, the jaw popping is again saying, I'm really anxious right now. And then they'll start doing guttural noises, and then body language. So usually when you, especially in the woods, if you come up on a black bear, they'll stand on their back feet. People perceive that as aggression as well. It's not. It's the bear is standing up to be able to see better.
Mm-hmm.
And also they see with their noses. So by standing up, it can get a 360-degree periphery through scent to understand what's going on and is somebody behind it, in front of it. So like aggression, the Florida black bear, I say over and over again, it's the closest thing we have to a true teddy bear in the world, maybe besides a koala or a panda bear. They're just incredibly shy, and they really don't want to have anything to do with humans. Mm-hmm. So if you see them and they're staying around you, it's usually around garbage cans and food, and it's the peak of their eating season. So they're willing to come out and get into that kind of thing. So yeah, it's when you need to be concerned is if all of a sudden the bear completely stops moving, completely stops communicating, gets eerily silent, looks down, won't look you in the eyes, and starts tucking its ears.
And that's when it's ready to attack.
Yeah. Because when they fight, they always attack the face. So they drop the ears, because that's usually one of the first things that gets ripped off. And they won't get eye contact with you, because that's a sign of aggression. So if that thing gets totally silent, totally motionless, turns its head down, and starts tucking its head like this, then you want to start thinking differently about the interaction. But having said that, not to frighten people, they started recording bear interactions and attacks in the 1970s when they first started protecting the Florida black bear. And there's only been 36 encounters official, zero deaths, and none of them were considered predatory. They were all considered defensive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happens, you know, 100%, 99% of the time. if you're going to have an interaction with the black bear, the bear feels cornered or threatened, or I would say the bulk of those. I actually went this morning and looked at the data, and almost there's always a question with it. Was there a dog involved? And it's almost always yes, yes, yes.
Because the dog is like attacking it or
and annoying. What people don't realize is that the dogs are the bear's arch enemy. Because in the wild, one of the only things it eats cubs is coyotes and wolves. So when a bear sees a dog, whether it's your little chihuahua or whatever, instinctually it is like fight or flight.
Okay.
So you see the videos on YouTube where like a little Yorkie will chase a black bear up a tree. That's why. Because instinctually they are just scared to death of dogs.
Wow.
And so if you're walking your dog, and this happens a lot, a dog will see a bear, starts barking at it at corners, and then the human runs up and reaches down to grab. Well, that bear is going to be swatting at you and that dog because it's scared to death. So if that happens, you don't ever want to go in to get your dog. Just know that that bear is not going to try and kill and eat that dog. It might swat at it if you, if your dog won't get away from it.
Yeah,
it's fascinating.
I remember when you told me some of the story before, especially the one when you were super close to the mama bear. And I asked, well, were you nervous? And you said, no.
Yeah.
How were you not nervous?
I have to think about this question. That's a good question because I've been asked that a lot. So my whole life I've been a little bit of an adrenaline junkie. And, as you get older, you start to be very real with yourself. And why do I do this? Mm-hmm. And this is self-destructive. And this... I believe it or not, I've talked to doctors about it with my mom, and I had to CAT scan once or something, and he just said that part of your brain doesn't activate as much as we would normally see. And
fearless.
Yeah. I think it's just a level of – it's for me, it's not a stupidity thing. Yeah. It's just, you feel fear as a healthy response to dangerous situations. But when I go into these situations, I have tons of footage – chest deep in black creeks, walking, having cottonmouth water moccasins swimming down the creek right at me, and then I just film them, and then they go right around my chest. And it's, in my mind, it's not a stupidity thing. It's I completely understand the situation. I understand what the dangers are, but I'm also reading what the animal is doing because they're constantly communicating with you, whether it's a snake or a bear, and they're also feeding off of you. So the second you start an interaction, they read your energy. And so like humans, you know this because you walk into a room and you had I had a gut feeling. Yeah. That's you're reading the energy of other people that's being given off. Same thing with animals. So if you stay calm and you understand what the signs and the communications are, it's very easy not to be frightened. For me, it's very easy not to be frightened.
Right. Well, I would say however you get there and however you have this ability is necessary for you to do it because I don't think you could do what you've been doing if you were nervous. And I think also, and I'm just speculating here, I think you love them so much.
Yes.
That your love supersedes, are they going to hurt me? And you're really trying to help them. And so.
I would say that's accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So snapshot of the conversation that you had given that evening at CSET Institute with like, loving animals and just being like very conscious of the earth, the ecosystem, biodiversity, which are all these almost buzzwords right now, but you had them going like well before it was a buzz, and what is going on right now. And you're trying to preserve the black bear and probably several other things because in the ecosystem, I don't know what on the food chain, what's before that and after that.
Yeah. It's definitely, I'm glad you brought this up because why has that always been so important to me for so long since I was 2 years old, even I've always, so when I was in school, when I graduated high school, I graduated, with a really high GPA, and I got full academic scholarships to go to multiple colleges. And when I first went to school, I majored in physics and art. And people are like, how does that even work? And in my mind, they're the same. Art, physics is the art of the universe. And so I've always viewed the world in a way where if I was a religious person, I would say God is an artist and all the biodiversity is the medium, it's the paints and the earth is the canvas. So it's never made sense to me why we would have all this if it wasn't important and it didn't play a part and we didn't need it. And so as I got older and started really delving into this and looking into it, it was just crystal clear to me. And for me, it was never, you know, years ago, you tend to get labeled a tree hugger if you were a conservationist. Mm-hmm. For me, it was never that. I was always like, it's not about being a tree hugger. It's about saving ourselves. And it's only been in the last 5 to 10 years that everybody's going, oh, that is what it is. It's literally saving yourself. You know. So if you think of your house, you have constant maintenance. Well, the planet has constant maintenance that all this biodiversity is doing for us to be able to survive and thrive. So yeah, I've just always had that understanding since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, my mom says, when I was like 5 or 6, I'd be in the room reading books on ecology or Native Americans, you know, and everybody else is out playing. She was like, you were always going to be an archaeologist. And then you told me when you were like, I think 5 or 6, that you were going to work at a zoo one day. And she was like, and then you worked at a zoo. And then,
Did you really work at a zoo? Oh, where was that?
South Florida. It was called the Dreher Park Zoo. Okay. And it was when I was in college. They it used to be a botanical garden, and then they took it over and turned it into a zoo. And I worked there for, I think, two or three years, lived in my van for the last two and worked two jobs so I could save all my money. And then I hit the road and lived in the van for a year before cell phones or anything. And I toured the entire country, went to every state and lived in the van. Yeah.
For a year or something?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Me and my dog. But yeah, I worked at that zoo because I had such a passion. And so I started at the zoo. I remember I went in to get the job and I was so young, and I'm being interviewed by the head of the zoo, and he was this older white gentleman with a, you know, mustache, and he's so serious. And I was interviewing for the job of boat captain. And so they had this tiny little lake and they had a pontoon boat, and they used to try and do tours on it, but they had just bombed because it's such a small lake. And so I was like, I want to revitalize this boat tour and talk about the ecology and the plants and the animals. And so I went in and I just sold myself. And he's like, all right, we'll give you 1 week to go out on the boat, figure out a tour, and then we're going to put all of our zookeepers on the boat. And if they say, wow, this is it. So I did that. I went out and I just got stacks of books, and I took the pontoon boat and sat it in the middle of the lake, and I would just lay there on my back and read, and I would look. And I got to the point where I could drive around the lake and we'd have maybe 15 people on the boat in a tour. And if I didn't say anything, they wouldn't see any animal. But if I did the tour, I would point out 100 animals that I'm like, there's this. And they're like, oh my God, it's right there. And so all of a sudden the tour grew and grew, and it got to the point by the end before I left where people would show up and the boat would be full from morning to night. Mm-hmm. And then I actually had in the winter, the Canadian geese would fly down, and it was, in the summer, it was the hottest time of the year, so it got really slow at that point. And there was this one goose that would always come in and hang out right by the kiosk where I do the boat tour, and it took me about a month and a half, but I completely tamed it to the point where I could hold it between my legs and pet it, and then it followed me everywhere.
Oh my gosh.
So when I would do the boat tour, the goose would swim behind the boat. And so everybody started calling it Tailgate. And so then we had these massive groups of kids that wanted to go to the zoo just to meet Tailgate.
Wow.
So we talked about doing a book on Tailgate and all this stuff. And Tailgate has a bit of a tragic ending. But yeah, I just always was involved in animals on some level like that. Yeah. So if I wasn't doing a job that involved it, I was always, you know, interacting in some way.
That's amazing.
Life. Yeah.
So obviously this is you. This is this is just who you are. This is who you were meant to be. I used to like going to zoos when I was younger, and I love animals. And then maybe 10 years ago, I'm like, how did I like going to zoos? Because they're so sad. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know like how I could have loved them so much and now loathe them so much. Because it's just entertainment and it's ridiculous.
And zoos, to be fair, are shifting, most of them. They're shifting in the sense of, you know, some of the bigger zoos, you go to them now and you go to this exhibit and you might not see that animal because now they're making it to where the animal can have its privacy.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
And what's saddest to me about zoos is that the bulk of the animals that are in zoos are there because they had to take them from somebody who shouldn't have them, and then they can't release them into the wild. Okay. So like everything we had at Dreher Park Zoo were animals that, you know, so-and-so had a Bengal tiger in his living room in a cage because he was this wealthy, famous person. And then they went and confiscated it. And they're like, what do we do with this thing? We either put it to sleep or, and so then we built an exhibit and put it in. But I agree 100%. Mm. It's not ideal, especially with the more intelligent animals. A lot of them tend to go crazy or they, if they don't have real strong stimulation. And then you look at, I mean, it's the same thing with our food systems right now. Mm-hmm. Everybody's eating farm salmon, but a salmon in the wild needs to swim thousands of miles a year. Mm-hmm. And when you farm it, it's living in a 1 acre yeah. pen. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, mm-hmm. it's like putting a bird in a cage and calling it a pet when its purpose in life is to fly. It's
right.
It's a little tricky.
Right.
It's a little tricky, yeah.
So then you... So it's always in you. You have such a love for it, and you can tell. And then you're doing your thing here. You get into videos. I know you then. You know what's going on. You're doing some really cool stuff with Prudence Farrow.
Bruns Farrow, yeah.
Bruns Farrow. And where did you go to India? What did you do?
I did. So that whole adventure was really driven by Jen, my partner.
Yeah.
So Prudence, who's Mia Farrow's sister, she wanted to do a film, I believe it was on the history of yoga. And so mm-hmm. she got this wild idea that she was going to go to India and film the Kumbh Mela, which is the largest gathering of humans on the planet. It's this big spiritual mm-hmm. festival. And so Jen, my partner, was like, I'm going. Like, and she weaseled her way and said to Prudence, her and Prudence were friends uh-huh. at the moment. Mm-hmm. And she said, I'm going. Prudence was like, okay, you're going. And so they were assembling this team. And this was at the point where there was a lot of really horrible things happening in India, especially towards women, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of attacks and that sort of thing. So I was like, you're not going without me. Like, there's no way I'm going to be able to
right.
not freak out if I'm sitting here and you're in India for a month. Uh-huh. And so I talked to the production team. And at that point, I'd been doing film. So I've been an artist my whole life, mm-hmm. and I've done every medium. When you and I first met, I was running Quincy because they sold toys, but they also sold art supplies. Mm-hmm. So I started there as an art teacher. Mm-hmm. And then I was just like, I just grew. And I'm like, mm-hmm. this isn't me. And then by the end of it, I was overseeing most of their operations mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, the internet and all that. But as an artist, my mother was an artist and a scientist. My father was very scientifically minded. So for them, date night was getting in the car and driving the highways in Texas at night to collect snakes and roadkill so they could put it in the jars and study it. And you know, all this craziness. Okay. And then when they first got married, they raised fish to sell to pet stores. And so they had like 300 aquariums in their house, and they had to stop the operation because the weight of the aquariums actually sunk the foundation 4 inches and it separated the walls from the foundation of the house. So they were always big into, you know, just crazy stuff.
This with is animals. Giving me a much more clear picture right now. Okay.
And it's wild because if you met my parents today, you'd be like, you're into animals, but they were always big into animals, like growing up and just fascinated by it. They both majored in biology and ichthyologists and all that. Mm-hmm. So the Prudence thing was, I had done all these different art forms. My mother was an amazing artist. She was one of the top scientific illustrators in the state of Florida. And so I grew up, you know, around her doing art. My dad could not do art if his life depended on it. He's more engineer-minded. Mm-hmm. But so I was always doing the art, and I was heavy into painting. But for me, the reason I got pushed into film was, of all the other mediums I did, they were very depressing for me because I'm just so mm-hmm. obviously intense, and mm-hmm. I can be a little obsessive compulsive in the sense that once I decide I'm going to do something, I'm in full. Mm-hmm. So with painting, I would go into a room and paint for 5 hours straight, but it was very depressing for
yeah.
me. Like, I wouldn't come out and feel great after mm-hmm. that experience. So even though I was very good at painting, and you are good at painting. Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd do a painting and it would go all over the world. I'm like, this isn't me.
Yeah.
Like, it's so depressing. It should be uplifting for mm-hmm. me, but it's because a lot of my art has always been a way to channel, you know, to get stuff out that I need to get out. And so if you're just always doing that in a closed off room by yourself, it can actually be counterproductive.
Yeah.
So the painting was like, this isn't me. Like, I love this. I love the end result, but the process is killing me. And film mm-hmm. was the first medium I found because I loved music. I loved all the art forms, and I did them very well, but it was the first one I found where I could bring it all together, and I interacted with a team mm-hmm. in a way that was very healthy mm-hmm. for me and very mm-hmm. uplifting. Mm-hmm. That's good. So that's why film was so good. So the Prudence project, I immediately said, I had just purchased a cinema camera because I was doing film before then, but I was kind of getting into the idea of moving into that. And I actually had a construction company at that point. I don't know if you remember.
Don't remember that.
Yeah. So It was during the first real estate boom on 30A, yeah. And the way I got into that is I would do these art projects for houses, and as you know, money escalated. People were like, "He is really good at this. We need you to build."
He can build our house.
Yeah. Well, he was like, "He can build this crazy sculpture thing," and I was doing that. Oh, but wow. Then I would come in, and they would watch me run a crew of people to build the sculpture, and they're like, "He's doing better than our contractor." So then people wanted me to do an addition. By the end of it, we got to the point where I had a full construction company. Right when I was about to go to India,
I did not know.
And this. You know, we rebuilt Great Southern in Seaside. I'm the one that tore that whole thing out, and in 7 days we tore the entire kitchen out, both kitchens, and rebuilt the whole thing.
Jim Shirley?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. We rebuilt parts of the, Pickles and Taco. We rebuilt so much of downtown Seaside, and then I was doing all kinds of work in Rosemary, and it was just growing and growing. But I sat down and said,
How
did I get here? Yeah. Like all of us say, yeah. I'm 30. How did I get here?
Yeah.
So the prudence thing was interesting because I'm like, oh, they're going to India. And I just got this camera. And I'm like, I need to get back in. Like how I got pulled from art into this is so bizarre. Mm-hmm. But I need to start getting back into the art. And so I just told Jen, I said, I'm coming. I'll just go for free. You know, if they can just cover my expenses of living, I just want to be there with you. So we arranged that. And then the woman who was the director of the project, her father fell ill and went to the hospital. So then they were like, no, we actually need you now because we need that camera person. Mm-hmm. And so, we went over and ended up living in Allahabad for a month and filming the Maha Kumbh Mela, which was insanity, but amazing. But that's what really solidified in my mind, this is what I'm going to do the rest of my life. And I don't know how long it's going to take me to get there to do that. And I also knew, I said, I'm going to do feature films. I just don't know when, because it's a transition in that not only does it take substantially more money to do a feature film, it also takes clearly years, to do one film.
Right.
So it's a big leap.
Right.
But that was definitely the transition
That's pretty unique.
Yes.
Place to be,
and
to stay there for a month. I mean, I do remember, you coming back from there, and the talk of it all was so fascinating.
Yeah. I think we got rid of half of everything we owned when we got home. Jen and I just went through the house.
Oh, yeah.
Get rid of it.
Well, that would do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would do it.
Yeah.
So then on the trajectory of your journey, when did the bear and your love for the bear and understanding that like so much growth was happening and things were all messed up with the ecology? And
so the big thing there was, so first and foremost, the absolute, what I would say, the godfather, the leader of this in the panhandle, in my opinion, especially in our years, MC Davis, Noguchi Biophilia, in terms of bringing people's awareness to what's really here. Mm-hmm. And to him, the godfather would be E.O. Wilson, which is why he called it the Biophilia Center. So what's fascinating about it is, for me, I always knew there was this immense biodiversity here, but I didn't understand why, and couldn't put my finger on, I just grew up, where you grow up, it's just where you grow up. So I just knew it was amazing because I was traveling all over the world. I was like, whoa, this place is different and special. But at the same time, it had been so devastated at the end of the Civil War going into the early 1900s that our area, in my opinion, is just now in part starting to come back and hit a point of health. Not old growth, but health, to where you're going to really start seeing some of these ecosystems established in a way that they were before, the mid-1800s.
How did it get there? How did it reestablish?
Because they've started protecting. So like Point Washington State Forest.
Oh, okay, so you
could
see the fruits of their labor was working.
Absolutely. And the biggest thing is not only are they protecting the lands now, but they're maintaining them. So a lot of people talk about the controlled burns, and they're like, oh my gosh, why are we doing this?
Yeah.
Well, the Native Americans did controlled burns for 14,000 years before white men even arrived here, and that is one of the main reasons there's so much biodiversity here, is the controlled burns. They did it for hunting, so they have a better visual, and because if you allow it to grow out of control here, you see how thick it gets, and you can't see anything. Well, that thickness is very, it's a lot of hardwoods, and it blocks out all these other plants. So the controlled burns are critical in terms of keeping down the plant species and stuff that not only inhibit lots of biodiversity in animals, but also plants. So I was talking to Matt Oresco, who's running Agusi, and when they first started restoring that, there was certain parts when they brought fire into it, all of a sudden plants that were on the endangered species list that nobody had seen there in 20 years all of a sudden started coming back. And so they were there just waiting for that fire to come back to bring them back.
Wow, that's interesting. So interesting.
Yeah. And so much of it was really, it's hard to understand this for so many people because they come down here and they're like, you know, this isn't the redwood forest, but I can show you pictures where this was just as spectacular as the redwood forest down here. You know, we had cypress trees that were, you know, 15, 20 feet in diameter. We had pine trees that got up to 4 or 5 feet in diameter. And I've gone into some of these ecosystems that are really hard to get to and fairly well protected, but they're coming back healthy. And it's like Avatar. You go in and you're like, holy cow, this is insane. You know, the plants that will eat lizards and mice and just incredible beauty and color. And it's spectacular. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So this is fascinating, and the story needs to be told because not a lot of people know it. It's not mainstream yet, but I mean, it's catching on. Yeah. So then what was the day you woke up and said, I am going to film a movie about the black bear?
I have to give most of that credit to Sean. So basically, when this started, I met with Sean. So Sean Couch, he was supposed to be here, but he couldn't today. But he runs the J.W. Couch Foundation, which was a foundation started when his grandfather passed. And their sole mission is it's a three-pillar foundation. So they have a leg that deals with historical, a leg that deals with education, and one that deals with environment. So every year they go out and help organizations in those three pillars. And so he and I first met because they had moved to the community. And you've known me long enough to know I hold things pretty close to the chest. So if I meet somebody, I'm not just...
Yeah.
So he was like, can you think of anything that my foundation could support in the area? And you know, I wasn't about to tell him about my project because I just didn't know him yet. And so I did a little tester and I said, well, my friend started this free clinic over in Point Washington, Hillary Glenn, Point Washington Medical Clinic. I said, I know they could use some help, and COVID was just hitting.
Yes.
And within a month, his foundation had bought them the mobile clinic that they have now. And I was like, ooh, this guy's, I like this guy.
Responsive.
Yeah. So he and I started talking, and I started liking him more. And it was clear that he was really interested in helping the community. And that was what was important to me. Because we get a lot of people that come in here and they get excited. They do something, then they're gone within a year. And I was like, I'm not interested in that.
Carpetbaggers.
Yeah. So I... that's what started the conversation, and then I started telling him about the project, and so he was like, let's do it. And so for me, it was two things. It was Sean and then Jen. Jen was like, you've been thinking about this project forever. Just do it. It's COVID. Now's the time to go out and live in the woods and do this thing. So I said, all right. So the first 6 months, his foundation was supporting it and funding the whole thing, and it was I was just 16 hours a day all over the panhandle, 7 days a week filming. And I mean, some of the places we filmed in, we had to get permission from the Pentagon to get into and,
really?
And film, because there's a lot of amazing stuff out at Eglin, but it's also close to their bombing ranges.
And that's you got the permission?
Yeah, and that's a bizarre story. I was out filming on the bomb range where they tested the Moab, the mother of all bombs, and I'm literally... you know, here with these cameras laying on the ground, filming burrowing owls, and there's a crater next to me where they've dropped bombs, and there's a blown up car here. I'm just like, it's so bizarre.
That is bizarre.
It's so bizarre. And that's the only population of these burrowing owls in the entire panhandle. So it's like, you want to get the footage, you got to go out here. But I had a handler with me at all times when I was out there. So not only did I get permission, but you had to have somebody with you, and they prevent you from going here and here. And some of it's like, they don't want you to see certain things, but a lot of it is probably for your own protection. So you don't go somewhere where they're going to be testing that day. Because you get out there and you're like, it's all tests. They build little, I'm like, that looks like Afghanistan, that little town we just drove by. And they come in and, you know, they'll practice saving people or bombing a village, whatever they need to do.
Yeah.
So there was that aspect. So I started filming, and then it was really Sean. What happened was, in my mind, it was a documentary. And when you look at a nature documentary, like a David Attenborough type thing, you know, Blue Planet, Planet Earth, they usually get a whole team of cinematographers, and each one has an assignment. Like, you for the next month are going to the mountains of Afghanistan, and your sole mission is to get this footage of this leopard that's never been filmed, and this is what we need. So that one person focuses for a month, 15 hours a day. So then you have me, and we had brought, we had pulled Chandler
from
MODIS into the project to help a little bit, and one or two other people to help get the footage. But I was the primary person capturing the footage. And so we're getting more and more and more footage, you're trying to figure out what the story is. And so in some ways we did this backwards. Mm-hmm. Usually with a nature documentary, you know what your story is. But with us, it was like, because we're telling the story of a place is coming back, we're not 100% sure what we're going to be able to capture. So mm-hmm. we need to go capture it first and pull the story out of the footage. So as we were doing that and we started coming up with an idea for the story, Sean's a father of four, and he kept getting these ideas of like, wow, to get the kids, let's do animation. Like animation, like we're talking money now, yeah. You know, like, I mean, it was already money, but now we're talking like big yeah. money. And so once I made contact with the Bears and started, and it was funny, let me back up a little bit. I'm the kind of person that once I commit to something, I'm not going to stop until I accomplish or I'm dead, one of the two. And so I've been going and going, and it's months, and we're meeting, and he's like, dude, like, this isn't happening. Trust me, we'll get the Bears. Just trust me, trust me, trust me. And then,
but he wasn't out there with you, was he?
Oh, no, no, no. It was okay, just
yeah.
me.
Yeah, yeah.
So the day I've got the first footage and I had my first mm-hmm. contact with the Bear, it was like, I told Jen, I was like, this is one of the best days of my life. I didn't think it would be that, but it was such a profound experience. And mm-hmm. then I came and showed him the footage, and he was just like, oh, my mm-hmm. God. And then he showed it to his board, and then they were like, yeah. whatever you need. And that's mm-hmm. when Sean said, let's up the scale and turn this into a feature film, which is something I would have always loved, but finance-wise, you know, I can't just say that. So he said that. Mm-hmm. And then once he said that, I took it and ran with it. And then I was like, well, you want to bring it to here? Let's bring it to here. Mm-hmm. You know, let's mm-hmm. really make this a world-class production. That's really what kicked it off. Mm-hmm. And then once that happened, he and I started working on the screenplay, and the way that came together was really fascinating for me, because that was the only time and the first time we were really butting heads, because he had an idea of it needed to go in here, and I'm like, no, this is my project, it's going to go this way. And his was way more like oriented towards kids, and it was just this fun storyline. It was less about not less about the biodiversity, but it wasn't as heavily on educating. It was more on like, we got to get their attention or they're not going to watch this. So we both said, look, you go write a screenplay. I'll write a screenplay. Let's come together and see which one's best and we'll vote on it. But the one thing we decided was the connecting thread between the two screenplays was every night this father and son would sit around a campfire and talk and tell stories. So he went off and wrote this whole screenplay, which was all based on animation, and I went off and wrote a screenplay based on my 2.5 years of living with the Bears and the experiences I had. And when we came together, we were like, oh, this, well, it wasn't just the same thing, but it weaved perfectly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so what it was is the animation became the stories that were told at night. So okay. the kid's imagination comes to life through. So his father tells the stories that he keeps in this journal, which was passed down from his father. So it's a deep, his history, story, and heritage, and like how the area became what it is today and what it can be again. Mm-hmm. And so when they sit around the campfire and they're telling these stories, you see the kids' imagination come to life, and that turns into animation. Mm-hmm. And so it was such an incredible weaving of the two screenplays. We both were just like, holy mm-hmm. cow, this was meant to be.
Kismet.
For sure. Kismet, yeah.
Did the anime start yet? The animation?
Yes.
And that's
so we've been working with the animators for over a year and a half. Before we filmed the live action portion, we storyboarded the entire film. So mm-hmm. every second of filming has 24 frames in mm-hmm. cinema. So we were filming 24 frames per second, but doing the storyboarding, you do one shot for each scene, you might do 15 shots. So when the crew shows up and hits the ground, I can say, this is what it looks like. This is where we're filming. This is how the actor moves. This is the lighting I need. It allows you. It's a big expense and a lot of work in the beginning, but it can allow you to pull off a film in 2 weeks, which would normally take 3 months, 4 months, 5 months.
Wow. So what's the projected date for the release?
The release is June of 2024 is what we're going for.
June of 2024. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the reason for that is that's when the last submission for the New Orleans Film Festival is.
Okay.
We can get it into submit it to all the other film festivals. They call them the Oscar Five.
Mm-hmm.
But I really want to submit to New Orleans just because it's in the Panhandle. Yeah. I think mm-hmm. they'll really embrace mm-hmm. this okay. project.
So imminent, you know, 8 months yeah. from now, something yeah. like that. And you'll be ready. You feel good about how you're pacing to
yes.
get that?
Yes, I feel good. You know, I've never done feature film animation, but the team we're working with is incredible. And anytime we get nervous and we're like, where are we at? They'll explain it. We're like, okay, we're on
yeah,
target.
On this target.
Is, yeah,
wow.
It's good. And they bring in such a massive team. You know, it starts mm-hmm. off right now, it's in-house. So they've got like, I think 10 people that are working on it.
Wow.
But once we've locked in what's called the animatic, which we're just locking in the next several days, they bring in like 15, 20 animators that work all day. And so like one person will be my sole job is to draw OC, the character, and that's all I do. And then another person's job is to color OC. And so, mm-hmm. you know, wow. they'll do three or four drawings a day, and they have to do thousands and thousands of them. So,
wow.
It's incredible.
I mean, that is unbelievable.
And you can understand why not many studios do the old hand-drawn Disney-style animation anymore.
But it looks so much better.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm just going to put this up. This is our August issue. And we had a big 6-8-page feature on you and your story here. And we were happy to tell it. I don't know what kind of response you got.
It's great. It's been excellent. Yeah, actually, I need to get some more of those from you. Everybody's been taking them. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, we have them. We always save. At least 200. We always save just in case somebody really wants them, you know, for whatever reason. So I guess this might be a good segue for you to talk about recent news on how you are going to weave this whole endeavor in with Aliquot Animal Refuge and what those next steps are.
Yeah. So, you know, a big part of this, the way we envision the Paper Bear, Sean and I envision it, is really the education force on this. And in our avenue and the way we thought about this was, we don't want to go down the real heavy, like, Blue Planet, Planet Earth, because that always has a smaller audience. I love those. They're amazing, but it tends to be a one-off watch. Mm-hmm. So we were thinking more like pop culture, Goonies-style film, adventure, mm-hmm. suspense, drama, love, all this stuff, and something that people would go back and watch over and over again. So, but in doing that, what's the bigger goal and what's the bigger mission? So much of it is partnering with and working with all these different organizations that we become the tool that's just feeding them this content that they can get out and they can share with their people and they can use it to, so all of our animated characters can become tools that these groups use. It's almost, I say, think about Smokey the Bear out west. We're about to have Tall and Max the Bear in the east here. Mm-hmm. So
got it.
So we're working with and partnering with, and I'm really excited because we've been working with Lori Hood up at Aliquot, and you know, Aliquot has been growing, and one of the issues they have is trying to become self-sustaining in the sense of, you know, driving people in to not only adopt the dogs, but also they're a wildlife refuge, so they need funding to help rehabilitate the animals that they're rehabilitating and releasing them into the wild. Mm-hmm. So part of that was the idea we had was marrying the Paper Bear with Aliquot in the sense that there would be like a Paper Bear education center up there, which would be almost like a Disney type experience where you get to walk into the sets from the film, interact in these sets. And so that is all starting to come together. She's one of the only people in the state that has a license to do a black bear sanctuary.
Really?
And so we're already looking at and having discussions about doing the black bear sanctuary. She wants to bring in red wolves mm-hmm. and the Florida panther mm-hmm. as well. And so, yeah, we're sitting that's, down and having talks.
Congratulations about, to all of you, Lori, too. You know, that's very exciting. I know for her, and mm-hmm. you know, she's done an amazing work, and she's put the time and effort. And boy, we've had a lot of conversations together about like, oh, gee, I'm almost gonna collapse. Oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah,
and you just keep going because obviously people like us have to have the same thought that you do, that when you start something, you're either gonna finish it or you're gonna die. Yeah. You know, easy peasy, right?
Exactly. So. And I can say that, it's funny because you say we've known each other for so long. It's so true. It's like the people that have been here, and I can only speak about here because it's where I'm live, but there's a handful of us that have really been here since the beginning. Yeah. And if it really created, I definitely see you and Jerry as those. And it's like they're the people that Jen and I have so much respect for because we are in that same mindset of like, this might kill me, but I'm okay with that.
That's right. Well, I mean, that I don't know how else to do it. Yeah. I would have preferred a much easier way, but that wasn't exactly what happened. This is definitely a part two and a part three podcast for sure, but it was awesome. So thank interesting. Yeah. I'm so proud of you.
Thank you.
And I just think it's remarkable.
Thank you.
What is going to end up happening. I cannot wait for the season opening, the opening night of that. It's going to be like something else.
We're excited. We're going to probably do a screening in the north part of the county. Okay. They're excited about that. So we'll definitely, you guys will be involved. All right. For sure.
Thank you.
Yeah,
well,
absolutely.
Thank you for your time, Eric. Right.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Hope you enjoyed it, everybody. What a story. What a, you know, remarkable, almost unreal, but it's true. And a surreal, wonderful story about what you can do when you want to do something. Mm. Thank you, everyone. Have a good day. Happy Friday. Bye.